believe that someone tricked this poor son of a bitch away from his home, implanted a neural network in his head, and then convinced him to play along with their plan, whatever that was, which somehow involved Bell. And then commit suicide, Van said. Don't forget that. How can I forget? I said. I talked to this guy's family today. On a brighter note, I got a judge to okay our record pull for Bell and Kearney, Van said. And? Bells don't tell us anything we didn't already know, Van said. Bell just signed a long-term contract with Lucas Hubbard, as in, just today. He is also first call with a bunch of well-off Haydens when he's not tied up with Hubbard. And then he does piecework for the NIH, just like every other integrator. Well, until next Monday when Abrams Kettering kills that little program. What about Kearney, I asked. He's got a long-term contract too, Van said. And, as it happens, his is with one Samuel Schwartz, lead counsel for Accelerant. That explains last night, I said. You lost me, Van said. Hubbard and Schwartz were at my dad's little soiree last night, I said. Hubbard was writing Bell, but Schwartz was writing a woman integrator. Said that his usual integrator had a previous engagement. Yeah, blowing up Loudon Pharma, Van said. Who was the woman integrator? I don't know, I said. You know it's not polite to ask. Go to the DC integrator listings, Van said. You'll find her. So, Bell with Hubbard and Kearney with Schwartz, I said. What about it? Doesn't that seem a little coincidental, I asked. That two integrators involved in weird shit on the same day work for the two most powerful people at the same corporation? Yeah, I said. Honestly? Van said. Yeah. But here's the thing about that. There's 10,000 working integrators in the whole world. Maybe 2,000 of them are in the U.S., so there aren't that many of them to go around. D.C.'s got maybe 20 in the area. Meanwhile, there are probably 100,000 Haydens in the area, because Haydens flock to urbanized areas that can support them. One integrator for 5,000 Haydens, you're going to see a lot of overlap. Maybe, I said. Definitely, Van said. If you want to start making connections, we're going to need more to go on. All right, one more data point to throw at you, I said. Medicord. What about it? Medical Care and Services Company, I said. Has the contracts here in the Navajo Nation. Okay, Van said, so? Medicord is part of Four Corners Blue Cross, I said. Guess who Four Corners Blue Cross is owned by? If you say Accelerant, you're going to make me unhappy, Van said. Have another drink, I suggested. I'm pacing myself, Van said. I want to be able to feel later tonight. A lot comes back to Hubbard and Schwartz and Accelerant, I said. We have too much piling up for it to be coincidence. I mean, hell, Schwartz is even Bell's lawyer. All right, Van said, but let me say it again. If you're going to suggest Schwartz was somehow complicit with the Loudon Pharma bombing, you're going to need more than an integrator contract. And you're forgetting that when the bombing was going down, Schwartz was at a party with one of the most famous men on the face of the earth and an FBI agent who, if hauled up in front of a court, would have to admit to seeing him there. You are his alibi, Shane. There is that, I said. Plus, Bear was actually Kearney's client, Van said. He contracted with him 3 times in the last 2 years. It's evidence of a prior relationship. Not all of my ideas are going to be gold, I said. Stop thinking for the evening, Van said. You've done enough for the day. When are you coming back? I'm about to finish up here, I said. The Window Rock police are letting me park my loaner 3 here for a couple of days in case I need to come back. Once that's squared away, I thought I might try visiting that place I'm renting a room in. Crazy idea, Van said. Get to it. Good night, Shane. Wait, I said. Talking to you is cramping my evening's planned festivities, Van said. Johnny Sonny, I said. What about him? The family wants the body back. When we're done with him, they're welcome to him. The FBI will work with them so they can have someone pick up the body. I don't think his grandmother and sister have that sort of money, I said. I don't know what to tell you about that, Shane, Van said. All right, I said. I'll let them know. I hung up and switched back over to my outside voice. I'm about done here, I said to Red House. No one's using that desk, he said, pointing to where I was sitting. If you want to just plug in there, there's a socket on the floor. Captain told me to ask you to let us know before you're going to drop by, but otherwise you're fine for a few days. I appreciate it, I said. Did you talk to them about Sonny's body? Red asked. I did, I said. When we're done with it, I'll give you a contact in D.C. to have the body shipped. That's not going to be cheap. When they find out how much it is, let me know, I said. I'll have it dealt with. Who do I tell them is dealing with it? Red House asked. Tell them it's an anonymous friend, I said. Chapter 11. I was on the corner of Pennsylvania and 6th Avenue, walking away from the Eastern Market Metro, when I heard them in Seward Square. A bunch of young, probably drunk, and almost certainly stupid dudes braying at each other about something. That in itself didn't interest me. Stupid, drunk young men are a fixture of any urban setting, especially in the evening hours. What got my attention was the next voice I heard, which was a woman's, and which didn't sound particularly happy. The calculus for that many drunk young men and a single woman didn't strike me as especially good, so I continued on Pennsylvania into Seward Square. I caught up with the group where the little walkway cut across the grass from Pennsylvania and Fifth. There were 4 dudes who had taken it on themselves to surround someone who I assumed was the woman in question. As I got closer, I saw that the woman was also a Hayden. That changed the dynamic of what was going on a bit. It also meant these guys were drunker or more stupid than I had previously guessed, or some combination of the two. The woman in the center of the dude pocket was trying to shoulder her way through the group. When she did, the 4 would move and reform their pocket around her. It wasn't entirely clear what they were planning to do, but it was also clear that they weren't interested in letting her get away. The woman moved again, and the 4 men moved again, and that was the first time I saw the aluminum bat one of them was carrying. Well, that was no good. So I walked up, making as much noise as threepily possible as I did so. One of the men caught the movement and got the attention of the others. In a minute, all 4 of them were looking at me, the woman still in the center of their pocket. The one with the bat was bobbing it lightly in his hand. "Hi there," I said. "Softball practice get out late?" "What you want to do is just keep walking," one of them said to me. It was clear to me that this was meant to be threatening, but he was pretty drunk, so it just came out as the drunk version of threatening, which isn't very threatening at all. "What I want to do is check on your friend here," I said, and pointed to the Hayden in the middle of the group. "Are you okay?" I asked her. "Not really," she said. "All right," I said, and then looked at each of the men in turn, using the second I held each one's gaze to scan their faces and send the scans to the FBI database for identification. "Here's my idea, then. Why don't you let her walk away? And then you all and I can talk about whatever it is you wanted to have a conversation with her about. It'll be fun. I'll even buy a round for you all." Because what you need is another drink, I thought, but did not say. I was trying to make this all nice and pretend friendly. I was pretty sure it wasn't going to work, but it was worth it to make the attempt. It didn't work. "How about you fuck off, you fucking clank?" said another one of them. He was just as drunk as the first, so this was as ineffectively blustery as the first threat. So I decided on a course of lateral motivation. "Terry Olson," I said. "What?" said the dude. "Your name is Terry Olson," I said, and then pointed to the next one. "Bernie Clay, Wayne Glover, and Daniel Lynch." I pointed to the one holding the bat. "Although I'd bet $20 that you go by Danny, and your last name is full of irony at the moment." "How do you know who we..." Olson began. "Shut the fuck up, Terry," said Lynch, thereby inadvertently confirming the identity of at least one of the 4. These guys were geniuses, all right. "He's right, Terry," I said. "You do have the right to remain silent, and you probably should. But to answer your question, I know who you are because I just did a facial scan of the 4 of you, and your information popped right up from the database I'm plugged into. It's the FBI database. I'm plugged into that database because I'm an FBI agent. My name is Agent Chris Shane." "Bullshit," Lynch said. I ignored him. "I tried to be nice to you, but that's not how you wanted to do this," I said. "So why don't we try it this way? While we've been standing here having our little conversation, I've already put in an alert to the Metro Police. Their station house is just 2 blocks away, which is something I have to believe you didn't know, because otherwise you wouldn't have been stupid enough to try to bash someone here. So, you are going to let her, I pointed to the woman, come over and stand by me, and then you four are going to go home. Because if you're still here when the cops show up, at least one of you is in trouble for underage drinking, Bernie. And at least one of you already has an assault charge on his sheet, Danny. The cops take a dim view of each. Three of the four looked at me uncertainly. The fourth, Lynch, I could tell was calculating his odds. I figure at least one of you is thinking he's not going to get into that much trouble for taking a shot at a threep, I said. So, this is where I remind you that DC law treats crimes against threeps the same as it does against human bodies. So, all of you are going to be on the hook for assault. And since it's pretty clear to me you're targeting this person because she's a Hayden, you've got a hate crime charge to go with it. So, you just want to think about that, I said. While you're thinking about that, I should mention that I've been recording this entire event from the minute I walked up, and that footage is already in the FBI's servers. So far, all I have is four guys being drunk and stupid. Don't let's change that. Terry Olson and Bernie Clay stepped aside. The woman began walking toward me. As she cleared the men, Lynch let out a grunt and pulled back the bat to take a swing at her head, which is when I zapped him, because I had my service stunner behind my back the entire time and had him already zeroed in as the target. All I really had to do was fire when my interior reticle went red. I had him pegged as one of those not-quite-clear-on-long-term consequences types as soon as I had walked up, on account of there was only one idiot in attendance with a bat. He'd come out to dance. The others were just drunken wingmen. Lynch stiffened and then fell to the ground, convulsing and vomiting. The other three men bolted. The woman knelt next to Lynch, checking him. "What are you doing?" I asked, coming up to the two of them. "I'm making sure he's not aspirating his own vomit," she said. "What are you, a doctor?" "As a matter of fact, yeah," she said. "Can you do that while I'm cuffing him?" I asked. She nodded. I cuffed him. "Great," I said, and stood back up. "Now I really do have to call the police." She looked up at me. "You hadn't already?" "I was pulling their data from the database and targeting this asshole," I said. "I was a little busy." "Why didn't you, if you don't mind me asking?" "They just seemed like harmless drunks," she said. "They came up from behind me and I didn't think about it until they started talking to me. And I didn't realize they were a problem until this asshole started asking me how far I thought my head would fly if he took a bat to it. Tell me you have that part recorded at least." "I do," she said. And I told him that I did. He just laughed. "I don't credit Mr. Lynch here with too many brains," I said. "Either that, or he figured that after he was done playing Babe Ruth with your head, there wouldn't be a recording left. Now, are you done examining him, doctor?" "I am," she said. "He'll live. And thank you, by the way." "You're welcome," I said. I held out a hand. "Chris Shane," I said. "I know who you are," she said, taking it. "I get that a lot," I said. The doctor shook her head. "It's not that," she said. "I'm Taylor Givens. I'm your new housemate." Taylor and I had just finished up our statements to the arresting officers when I noticed someone walking up on us. It was Detective Trin. "Detective Trin," I said to her. "This is unexpected." "Agent Shane," she said. "You've had an exciting evening." "Just wrapping up," I said. "You planning to make a federal case out of this one, too?" "Not really," I said. "The Hayden in this case lives in D.C., so this is going to be handled by Metro." "That's probably wise," Trin said. "Are you planning to be involved?" I asked. "We're in the first police district right now. I was under the impression you worked out of the second." "I work out of the second," Trin said. "I live here. I was having a drink at Henry's when the report came in over the radio. Thought I'd come over and see how you were doing." "I'm fine now," I said. "And maybe to have a chat with you." "All right," I said. "Privately," Trin said, nodding to Taylor. I looked over to Taylor. "You want me to get them to take you home?" "We're less than 100 yards from where we live," Taylor said. "I think I can make it on my own." "All right," I said. "See you there soon," she said, and headed home. "You live with her?" Trin asked as Taylor walked off. "New housemate," I said. "This is actually the first time I've met her." "Interesting way to meet your new housemate," Trin said. "She's lucky you were around. We've been having a spike of Hayden bashings today." Why is that? I asked. The walkout and the stunt with the trucks on the loop, but I'm sure you knew that, Trin said. When you spend days making it difficult for other people to do their thing, they get pissy about it. And because so many of you are flooding into town for the march, there are lots of targets of opportunity, as it were. It's open season on Threeps. We had 5 attacks in the 2nd District today. And how do you feel about it? I asked. I'll be happy when the march is over and I can get back to busting college kids for peeing on the sidewalk. Huh, I said. What can I help you with, Detective Trin? I was curious about what you think of your new partner, Trin said. We get along so far, I said. You heard about her last partner. What about her? Did Van tell you what happened with her? I understand there was a mishap with a firearm, I said. That's one way of putting it, Trin said. There are other interpretations. Like what? Like, Van's partner decided putting a bullet in her gut was a better option than dealing with Van anymore. Seems drastic, I said. Desperate times, Trin said. Desperate measures. I don't know anything about that, I said. No, I guess you wouldn't, Trin said. You also know Van used to be an integrator. I'd heard that, I said. Ever wonder why she quit? I've known her for 2 days, I said, one of which I mostly spent in the mountain time zone, so we haven't had time to exchange life stories. Pretty sure she knows yours, Trin said. Everyone knows mine, I said. It's not a big trick. Let me catch you up on hers then, Trin said. She left because she couldn't hack it. The government spent all that money making her an integrator, and she ended up being phobic about people using her body. You might want to get her to tell you about her last couple of integration sessions. The rumors about them are pretty dramatic. I wouldn't know about that either, I said. It explains all the self-medicating, Trin said. Unless you've missed the smoking and drinking and bar hopping and looking for people to bang. I've noticed it, I said. She's not hugely picky on that score. Really, I said. Does that explain you, then? Trin smiled at me. I never fucked Van, if that's what you're asking. I'm not entirely sure about her and her old partner, though. I don't suppose it will be an issue with you. Do you have a problem with Hayden's, Trin? I asked. Because you don't just punt in a crack like that last one right out of the blue. I don't think you understood me, Trin said. I think it's a good thing she won't have an opportunity to fuck with you that way. But I won't be surprised if she finds another way to do it. Right, I said. Look, Trin, it's late, and I've had a really long day. So if you could get to the point of this little conversation, I'd appreciate it. I mean, aside from you taking a dump all over my new partner. The point is that you should be thinking about your partner, Agent Shane, Trin said. She's smart, but not as smart as she thinks she is. She's good, but not as good as she thinks she is either. She talks a good game about what other people should be doing, but when it comes to her own shit, she gets sloppy. Maybe you've noticed that already, and maybe you haven't, but speaking as a voice of some experience on that matter, if you haven't noticed it yet, it's something you'll notice soon. She's a ticking time bomb ready to explode, and I don't want to be anywhere near her when she goes off, I said, straight from the cliché checklist. Got it. Trin held her hands in a way that expressed bored equanimity. Maybe I'm wrong, Shane, she said. Maybe I'm just an asshole who had a bad experience with her when I had to deal with her. And maybe the two of you will get along just fine, and you won't feel like putting a bullet into your gut or whatever. In which case, great. I hope the two of you are happy together. But then, maybe I'm not wrong. In which case, watch your partner, Shane. I'll do that, I said. There's some weird shit going on with Hayden's, Trin said. That thing at the Watergate, and I know you're involved with whatever's happening with Loudon Pharma. If the two of you are working on something big, then the last thing you're going to need is her falling apart. When she goes down, you don't want her to take you with her. More cliches, I said. Trin nodded. It's a cliche, fine. On the other hand, you're one of the most famous Haydens out there, aren't you? Or used to be, anyway. Still famous enough that people called you a scab for showing up to work the other day. How will it look when you fuck up because of Van, Shane? How will it look for your dad, the next senator from Virginia? I didn't have anything to say to that. Just a little something for you to think about, Trin said. Take out whoever you want. Have a good night, Shane. Hopefully you don't have to save anyone else before you get home. She walked off. There was a welcoming committee of Threeps waiting for me when I got to the townhouse. They tossed confetti at me when I walked through the door. Whoa, I said, fending off the tiny bits of paper. We wanted to make you feel at home on your first night, Tony said. I don't usually have confetti thrown at me when I come home, I said. Maybe you should, Tony said. Why do you have confetti anyway? I asked. Leftover from New Year's, he said. Never mind that now. We also wanted to thank you for stepping in with Taylor's little problem out there. She told us about it when she came home. It's not the usual way to meet your new housemate, Taylor said. Let's not make it a regular thing, I said. I would be okay with that, Taylor said. And these are your other new flatmates, Tony said, pointing at the two remaining threeps. That's Sam over there. Hey, Sam said, raising a hand. Hello, I said. And this is the twins, Justin and Justine, Tony said, pointing to the remaining threep. I was about to ask for clarification when a text popped into my field of vision from Tony. Go with it. I'll explain later, it said. Hello, I said to the twins' threep. Hello, at least one of the twins said back. Can we do anything for you to make you comfortable? Tony asked. I know you've had a fun-filled couple of days. Actually, all I want to do right now is get some sleep, I said. I know that's not very exciting, but it's been a really long day. Not a problem, Tony said. Your room is like you saw it the last time you were here. The desk chair has an induction pad in it. It should work for you until you get something better in there. Perfect, I said. In that case, good night, everyone. Wait, said the twins, and then handed me a balloon. We forgot to throw this at you when you came in. Thanks, I said, taking it. We blew it up ourselves, the twins said. I thought about the implications of that statement. How? I finally asked. Don't ask, they said. Chapter 12. And of course, I couldn't sleep. After 3 hours of trying, I finally gave up and went to my cave. For a Hayden, personal space is a touchy subject. In the physical world, there has always been a debate on how much space a Hayden actually needs. Our bodies don't move, and most of them are in specialized medical cradles of greater or lesser complexity. A Hayden needs space for their cradle and the medical equipment that attaches to it, and strictly speaking, that's all we need. Likewise, for our threeps, space shouldn't be an issue. Threeps are machines, and machines shouldn't need personal space. A car doesn't care how many other cars are in the garage. It just needs space to get in and get out. Put both of those together, and when people first started designing spaces for Haydens and their threeps, they were all like the efficiency apartments Latasha Robinson showed me. Small, clinical, no nonsense. Then people started noticing that Haydens had developed a spike of major depression, independent of the usual causes. The reason was obvious if anyone took any time to think about it. Hayden bodies might be limited to their cradles, and threeps might be machines. But when a Hayden was driving a threep, they were still a human being. And most human beings aren't happy feeling like they live in a closet. Maybe Haydens don't need as much physical space as naturally mobile people, but they still need some. Which is why those efficiency apartments were the Hayden residents of last resort. In the non-physical world, not the virtual world, because for a Hayden, the non-physical world is as real as the physical one, there is the Agora, the great global meeting place of the Haydens. Dodgers, the people who aren't Haydens, tend to think of it as something like a three-dimensional social network, a massively multiplayer online game in which there are no quests other than simply standing around talking to each other. One reason they think this is because the public area is open to Dodgers and, yes, we call them Dodger Stadiums, work very much like that. Explaining how the Agora works to someone who is not a Hayden is like explaining the color green to someone who is colorblind. They get a sense of it, but have no way to appreciate the richness and complexity of it because their brains literally don't work that way. There's no way to describe our great meeting places, our debates and games, or how we are intimate with each other, sexually or otherwise, that doesn't sound strange or even off-putting. It's the ultimate in you have to be there.
For all of that, in the Agora proper, there is no substantial sense of privacy. You can close off the Agora for periods of time or temporarily create structures and rooms for exclusivity. People are still people with their cliques and groups. But the Agora by design was built to create a community for people who were always and inevitably isolated in their heads.
It was built open on purpose, And in the two decades since its creation, it had evolved into something with no direct analog in the physical world. It's an openness that leaks into how Haydens deal with each other in the physical world as well. They leave their IDs visible, have common channels, and swap information in a way that would strike Dodgers as promiscuous and possibly insane. Not all Haydens, mind you. Haydens who were older when they contracted the disease were tied more deeply into the physical world, where they had already spent almost all of their lives.
So after contracting the disease, they lived mostly in their threeps and used the Agora, to the extent they used it at all, as a glorified email system. The flip side of this were the Haydens who contracted the disease young and were less attached to the physical world, preferring the Agora and its system of living to forcing their consciousness into a threep and clanking through the physical world. Most Haydens existed between the two spaces, both in the Agora and in the physical world, depending on circumstance. But at the end of the day, neither the physical world or the Agora could provide what most Haydens really needed, a place where they could be alone.
Not isolated, not the lock-in that Haydn syndrome forced on them, but by themselves, in a place of their own choosing, to relax and think calmly. A liminal space between worlds, for themselves and the select few that they chose to let in. What that liminal space is depends on who you are and also the computing infrastructure you have to support it. It can be as simple as a house from a template stored on a shared server, free tract housing supported by ads that presented themselves in picture frames, which computationally collapsed once the Haydn went out the door, to immense, persistent worlds that grew and evolved while the very rich Haydens who were the world's owners resided in floating palaces that hovered over their creations. My liminal space was something in between those two. It was a cave, large and dark, with a ceiling from which glowworms hung, imitating a nighttime sky. It was, in fact, a recreation of the Waitomo Caves in New Zealand, if the caves were about 10 times larger and had no traces of being a tourist attraction. In this cave, cantilevered out over a dark, rushing subterranean river, was a platform on which I would stand or sit in the single, simple chair I put there. I almost never let people into my cave. One of the few times I did was when I was dating another Haydn in college, who looked around, exclaimed, "It's the Bat Cave!" and started to laugh. The relationship, already a bit rocky, blew up not long after that. These days I think the comment was more on point than I would like to admit. Up to that point, I had spent a lot of my time being a public person whose movements were followed no matter where I was. My own space was dark and silent, a place where I could be an alter ego, one who could methodically hack away at homework or muse on whatever notions of mine were posing as deep thoughts at the time. Or, in this particular case, attempt to fight crime. Over the last 2 days, too much had been happening to allow me to spin out all the connections between events, to process the data and maybe get something useful out of it. Now was the time. I was up and awake anyway. I started pulling images out of memory and throwing them up into the darkness. First, the image of Johnny Sani, dead on the carpet of the Watergate Hotel. This image was followed by the image of Nicholas Bell, hands up, on the hotel room bed. Samuel Schwartz and Lucas Hubbard followed, represented here not by threeps or integrators, but by file photos of their approved media icons, images based on their physical body's facial features, but altered in such a way to give them the appearance of mobility and vitality. The icons were artificial, but I couldn't fault them for it. They weren't the only Haydens with approved media icons. I had one. Or used to, in any event. Next up, Carl Baer, from an image taken from his Loudoun Pharma ID, and Jay Kearney, from his integrator license. I paused for a moment to access the integrator database to find the woman Schwartz had integrated with the night before. Her name was Brenda Rees. Up her image went. After a moment of consideration, up went images of Jim Buchold and my father, the latter mostly for my own internal sense of navigation. Finally, I put up a placeholder image for Cassandra Bell, who had no approved media icon. Now to add connections. Sani connected to Nicholas Bell. Nicholas Bell to Hubbard, Schwartz, and his sister Cassandra. Hubbard to Schwartz, and to my father. Schwartz connected to Hubbard, my father, Brenda Rees, and Jay Kearney. Kearney to Schwartz and Bear. Bear to Kearney and Buchold. Buchold back to Dad. It was a cozy little sewing circle. Background now. Off of Sonny, I placed his last money order to his grandmother, paused for a moment to access the FBI server to make a request to search the serial and routing numbers to get its location of origin. That done, I popped up the Window Rock computing facility and drew a line off of it for Metacord and connected that back to Lucas Hubbard. From Buchold, I connected a line to Loudon Pharma. I did a search on the news stories of the day about the bombing. Bear's confessional video had been first leaked and then officially released, so intense speculation was now falling on Cassandra Bell for being either explicitly or implicitly connected to the bombing. I put a line from her to Loudon Pharma. Off of Cassandra Bell, I ran a search of stories on the Hayden work stoppage and the upcoming march on the mall. Trin hadn't been lying. In the last day, there were 20 attacks on Hayden's in Washington, D.C. alone. Most of those came in the form of attacks on threeps. There were some bashings, like the one I broke up, but also a couple where people took manual control of their cars and ran them into threeps. One person pushed a threep into the path of a bus, damaging both the threep and the bus. I wondered what the thinking was there. Killing a threep didn't do anything but wreck the hardware, which was replaceable, while the person attacking the threep was still on the hook for physically assaulting a person. Then I recalled Danny Lynch to memory, and remembered that logical thinking was not the strong suit in many of these encounters. In at least a couple of these attacks, it was the Hayden who ended up on the winning side of the encounter, which had its own set of problems. Videos of android-like machines thumping on human bodies called up something atavistic in the dumber, usually male, usually young, quarters of humankind. I didn't envy the Metro Police the next several days. A ping from the FBI server. The money order had come from the post office in Duarte, California. I popped up an encyclopedia article on the city and learned that its civic motto was City of Health, which seemed pretty random until I saw that it was the home of the City of Hope National Medical Center. The City of Hope helped develop synthetic insulin and was deemed a comprehensive cancer center by the National Cancer Institute. Also, and more relevantly for my purposes, it was one of the top five medical institutions in the country for Hayden syndrome research and treatment. If Johnny Sonny was going to get a neural network installed, that would have been a good place for it. But then, if he had gotten a neural network installed there, he would have popped up in our databases. I went back to Cassandra Bell and opened up a search on her, plucking out an encyclopedia biography and recent news articles not attached to Loudon Pharma. Cassandra Bell was one of the very few Haydens who had never not been locked in. Her mother contracted Haydens while she was pregnant with Cassandra and passed it on to her in the womb. Normally, that would have been fatal. In the large majority of cases where a pregnant woman contracted Haydens, the virus slipped past the placental barrier like it wasn't there and ravaged the unborn child. Only about 5% of the unborn who contracted Haydens survived to birth. Almost all of them were locked in. Half of those who survived childbirth died before the first year due to the virus suppressing the infant's immunological system or other complications brought on by the disease. Nearly all those who survived after that experienced severe issues brought on by the damage the virus did to the early brain development of the child and by the isolation Haydens created stunting their early emotional and social development. That Cassandra Bell was alive, intelligent, and sane qualified her as some sort of minor miracle. But to call her normal might have been stretching.
She was raised almost entirely inside the Agora, first by her mother, who ended up being locked in.
When she died from unrelated factors when Cassandra was 10, the girl's upbringing was shepherded by Hayden foster parents and her older brother Nicholas, who had been infected at the same time as his mother and who developed his integrator abilities then. In her way, Cassandra was as famous as I had been, another public curiosity among the Haydens. Far from being intellectually stunted, Cassandra showed remarkable mental acuity, passing a high school equivalency test at age 10 and then rejecting admission to MIT and Caltech because they would have required her to use a threep, which she refused to do. Instead, she became an activist for Hayden's separatism, arguing that Hayden should let go of the limitations of the physical world imposed on them by use of threeps and embrace and extend the metaphor of living
that the Agora afforded.
She didn't suggest Hayden's not interact with Dodgers, just interact with them on their own terms rather than on the Dodgers. One's receptiveness to Cassandra Bell's arguments correlated significantly to how much time one spent in the physical world
versus the Agora.
But the number of Haydens willing to listen to her had increased significantly once Abrams Kettering picked up traction and was then signed into law. It was she who suggested and instigated the walkout. It was also rumored that she was finally going to breach the physical world to speak at the March on the Mall this upcoming weekend. Basically, at the tender age of 20, Cassandra Bell was compared to Gandhi and Martin Luther King by her admirers, and to various terrorists and cult leaders by her detractors. Bears and Kearney's actions at Loudoun Pharma would not be helping her image at the moment, and people were already beginning to thump on Hayden's, including her, for the walkout. I scrolled through her recent comments and proclamations to see what she had to say about the bombing. On that, she was, for the moment, silent. This was not helping her in the media. Still, possibly better to be silent than to say something stupid. On reflection, it seemed strange that I had never met Cassandra Bell. We were two of the most notable young Haydens in existence, but then the majority of her notoriety began to accrue around the same time I was trying to step away from the limelight and try to have something like a private life. Also, be honest, I said to myself, you're the establishment, she's the radical. And that was true enough. Through my father and his activities, I was in the physical world more than most young Haydens. Cassandra Bell, on the other hand, was never in it, other than by reputation. I set aside Cassandra Bell for a moment and went back to Jay Kearney, who had blown himself up on Carl Baer's behalf. A scroll through his client list confirmed, as Van had said, that Baer was indeed a client of Kearney's, with 3 appointments in 21 months. The last of these was 11 months ago. According to Kearney's appointment notes, they went parasailing. But aside from brief notes on the nature of their appointments, there was nothing apparently connecting the two that I could see. 3 appointments in 2 years was evidence of a prior relationship, but it wasn't much of a relationship. The FBI had gotten warrants for every scrap of Bear's and Kearney's lives the instant it was clear they had done the bombing. I reached into that data trove to pull out messages and payment records. I wanted to see how much crosstalk there was between them, either in personal correspondence or in a financial trail of crumbs that suggested that the two of them interacted in any significant way. There was very little. The messages clustered around integration appointments and discussed things like potential activities, how much Kearney would charge for his time, and other pedestrian affairs. Likewise, their financial records coincided at integration appointments only, when Baer would pay Kearney for the appointment. This lack of a trail didn't mean that the two of them didn't meet or plan the bombing. It only suggested that, if they did, they weren't idiots about it. But it didn't seem a lot to go on. I stopped and looked up, and stepped back from the wall of images and searches I had constructed, looking for the structure in it and in the connections. I imagine to a lot of people it would look like complete chaos, a mess of pictures and scraps of news. I found it calming. Here was everything I knew so far. It was all connected in one way or another. I could see the connections out here in a way I couldn't see them when they were jumbled in my brain. Next steps, I heard Van say in my head. I smiled at it. 1. There were 2 nexuses of interaction that I saw. 1 was Lucas Hubbard, to whom Nicholas Bell, Sam Schwartz, and my father connected, and with whom Jim Buchold argued on a matter related to their mutual business. The other was Cassandra Bell, to whom Nicholas Bell, Baer, and Kearney were connected, whom Buchold was antagonistic toward, and Hubbard, possibly based on his argument with Buchold, was sympathetic toward. So, dive into both, particularly Cassandra Bell. She was the only person in all of this whom I had not physically met. Arrange an interview if at all possible. 2, Baron Kearney, still unconvinced about the connection here. Dig deeper. 3, Johnny Sani. Find out what he was doing in Duarte, and if anyone knew him there. Learn if there was a connection between him and the City of Hope. 4, 2 outliers in this tangle. My dad and Brenda Rees.
I was pretty certain my dad was not up to no good, running for senator notwithstanding.
In any event, I had a massive conflict of interest if I wanted to investigate him. As for Brenda Rees, might as well get an interview with her and see if she has anything useful to say. 5, Nicholas Bell. Who says he was working when he met with Sonny, but also appears to have been there to integrate with Sonny, even though it was impossible because they were both integrators and because the headset was fake. So what the hell was really going on in there? And why did Johnny Sonny commit suicide? Those were the two things that, taking all these data points out of my brain and spreading them out into space, didn't make any clearer. Chapter 13. A light ping echoed through my cave. I recognized the tone as a non-invasive hail, a call that would be delivered if the recipient was conscious, but not if not. Haydens, like anyone else, hated to be woken up by random calls in the middle of the night. I pulled up a window to see who it was. It was Tony. I cleared the call, audio only. "You're up late," I said. "Deadline on a gig," Tony replied. "I had a hunch you might have been lying when you said you wanted to sleep." "I wasn't lying," I said. "I just couldn't sleep." "What are you doing instead?" "Trying to figure out a whole bunch of shit that unfortunately I can't tell you much about. And you?" "At the moment, compiling code, which I can tell you about, but which I don't imagine you care about," Tony said. "Nonsense," I said. "I am endlessly fascinated." "I'll take that as a challenge," Tony said. And then the data panel popped up a button. "That's a door code. Come on over." Tony was offering me an invite to his liminal space, or at least a public area of it. I hesitated for a second. Most Haydens were protective of their personal spaces. Tony was offering me an intimacy of sorts. I hadn't known him that long. But then I decided I was overthinking it and touched the button. It expanded into a door frame, and I stepped through. Tony's workspace looked like a high-walled retro video game cube, all black space with the walls defined by neon blue lines, off of which branched geometric patterns. "Don't tell me, let me guess," I said. "You're a Tron fan." "Got it in one," Tony said. He was at a standing desk, above which a neon-lined keyboard hovered. Beside that was a floating screen with code, with a toolbar slowly pulsing, marking the amount of time until Tony's code compiled. Above him, rotating slowly, was a swirl of lines, apparently haphazardly connected. I recognized them immediately. "A neural network," I said. "Also got that in one," Tony said. His self-image was, like most people's, a version of his physical self, fitter, more toned, and stylishly clothed. "If you really want to impress me, you'll tell me the make and model." "I haven't the slightest idea," I admitted. "Amateur," Tony said, lightly. "It's a Santa Ana Systems Da Vinci Model 7. It's their latest released iteration. I'm coding a software patch to it." "Should I be seeing any of this?" I asked, pointing at the code in the display. "I would guess this is all supposed to be confidential." "It is," Tony said, "but you don't look like much of a coder to me. No offense. And I'm willing to guess that the Da Vinci up there looks mostly like artfully arranged spaghetti to you." "That it does." "Then we're fine," Tony said. "And anyway, it's not like you can record anything in here." Which was true. In personal liminal spaces, visitor recording was turned off by default. I looked up at the model of the neural network hovering over Tony's head. "It's strange, isn't it?" I said. "Neural networks in general, or the Da Vinci 7 in particular?" Tony asked. "Because confidentially speaking, the D7s are a pain in the ass. Their architecture is kind of screwy." "I meant in general," I said, and looked up again. "The fact we've got one of these sitting in our skulls." "Not just in our skulls," Tony said, "in our brains. Actually in them, sampling neural activity a couple thousand times a second. Once they're in, you can't get them out. Your brain ends up adapting to them, you know. If you tried to remove it, you'd end up crippling yourself more than we already are. That's a cheerful thought. If you want really cheerful thoughts, you should worry about the software, Tony said. It governs how the networks run, and it's all really just one kludge after another, he pointed at his code. The last software update Santa Ana put out accidentally caused the gallbladder to get overstimulated in about 0.5% of the operators. How does that happen? Unexpected interface between the D7 and the brain's neural signals, Tony said. Which happens more often than it should. They run all the software through brain simulators before they upload it into customers, but real brains are unique, and Hayden brains are even more so because of how the disease messes with the structure. So there's always something unexpected going on. This patch should fix the problem before it causes gallstones. Or, at least, if gallstones happen, they won't be traced back to the neural network. Wonderful, I said. You're making me glad it's not a Santa Ana network in my head. Well, to be fair, it's not just Santa Ana, Tony said. He nodded at me. What do you have in there? It's a Raytheon, I said. Wow, Tony said. Old school. They got out of the neural network business a decade ago. I didn't need to hear that, I said. Tony waved it off. Their maintenance is handled by Hubbard, he said. Excuse me? I said. I was momentarily shocked. Hubbard Technologies, Tony said. Lucas Hubbard's first company before he formed Accelerant. Hubbard doesn't build the network. Another Accelerant company does that. But Hubbard makes a lot of money off of maintaining the systems of companies who left the field after the first gold rush. He did a lot of the early coding and patching himself, if you believe his corporate PR. Okay, I said. The sudden intrusion of Hubbard into my head, literally as well as figuratively, had thrown me off. I've done work for Hubbard too, Tony said. Just a couple of months ago, as a matter of fact. Trust me, they have their issues. Do I want to know? I asked. Suffered any colon spasms recently? I said, no. Then nothing you need to worry about. Lovely. I've worked with them all, Tony said. All the networks. The biggest issue isn't neural interference, actually. It's basic security. Like people hacking into the neural networks, I said. Yeah. I've never heard of that happening. There's a reason for that, Tony said. First, the architecture of the neural networks is designed to be complex to make them hard to program on and hard to access from outside. The D7 being a pain in the ass to deal with is a feature, not a bug. Every other network since the first iteration is designed that way, too. Second, they hire people like me to make sure it doesn't happen. Half my contracts are for white hat incursions trying to get into the networks. And what do you do when you get in? I asked. Me? I file a report, Tony said. With the first iteration of networks, the hackers would run blackmail schemes, fire up a series of gory pictures, or put It's a Small World on a repeating loop until the victim paid to make it stop. That sucks, I said. Tony shrugged. They were dumb, he said. Honestly, a computer inside your brain? What the hell did they think was going to happen with that? They got serious about patching when some hacker from Ukraine started giving people arrhythmia just for kicks. That shit's actual attempted first-degree murder. I'm glad they fixed that, I said. Well, for now, Tony said. His code had compiled, and he waved his hand to execute it. From above, the network pulsed. It wasn't just a pretty image. It was an actual simulation of the network. What do you mean for now? I asked. Think about it, Chris, Tony said. He pointed at my head. You've got what's effectively a legacy system in your head. Its upkeep is currently being paid for out of the budget of the National Institutes of Health. When Abrams-Kettering goes into effect next Monday, the NIH will stop paying for upkeep once its current batch of contracts expire. Santa Ana and Hubbard aren't updating and patching out of the goodness of their corporate hearts, you know. They get paid to do it. When that stops, either someone else is going to have to pay for it, or the updates stop coming. And then we're all screwed, I said. Some people will be screwed, Tony said. I'll be fine because this shit is my job and I can hack my own network. You'll be fine because you can afford to hire someone like me to maintain your network. Our roommates will be fine because I like them and don't want them to have spam piped into their brains against their will. And the middle-class Haydens will probably be able to pay for a monthly subscription of updates, which is something I know Santa Ana, at least, is already planning for. Poor Haydens, on the other hand, are kind of fucked. They'll either get no updates, which will leave them vulnerable to software rot or hacking, or they'll have to deal with some sort of update model that features, I don't know, ads. So every morning before they can do anything else with their day, they'll have to sit through 6 goddamn advertisements for new threeps or nutritional powder or bags for their crap. So, spam, I said. It's not spam if you agree to it, Tony said. They just won't have much of a choice. Swell. It's not just the updates, Tony said.
Think about the Agora.
Most of us think of it as a magical, free-floating space somewhere out there. He gestured with his hands. In fact, it's run out of an NIH server farm outside of Gaithersburg. But it's not on the chopping block, I said. There'd be a panic if it was. It's not being cut, no, Tony said, but I know the NIH is talking to potential buyers. He pointed up at the neural network. Santa Ana's putting in a bid, Accelerant's making one, GM's in, and so is just about every Silicon Valley holding company. He shrugged. Whoever eventually buys the farm will probably have to promise to leave the character of the Agora unchanged for a decade or so, but we'll see how much that'll be worth. It's going to be monthly access fees from there for sure. I don't know how you'd do billboards in the Agora, but I'm pretty sure they'll figure it out sooner than later. You've thought about this a lot, I said, after a minute. Tony smiled, looked away, and made a dismissive wave. Sorry. It's a hobby horse of mine, I know. I'm not this humorless about most things. It's fine, I said, and it's fine that you're thinking about it. Well, there's also the side effect that once all these government contracts go kerplooey, my line of work is going to get tougher, Tony said. So this is not me being socially active out of the goodness of my own heart. I like to eat. Well, be fed nutritionally balanced liquids anyway. The Haydens who are walking out this week are making the point that our world is about to be wildly disrupted, and the rest of America doesn't really seem to give a shit. You're not part of the walkout, though, I said. I'm inconsistent, Tony said. Or maybe I'm a coward. Or just someone who wants to bank as much money as he can now because he expects things to dry up. I see the wisdom of the walkout. I don't see it as something I can do right now. What about the March on the Mall? I asked. Oh, I'll definitely be going to that, Tony said, and grinned. I think we'll all be going. Are you planning on it? I'm pretty sure I'll be working it, I said. Right, Tony said. I guess this is a busy week for you. Just a little. Got thrown into the deep end, it looks like, Tony said, looking back to his code. You picked a hell of a week to start your gig. I smiled at that and looked up again at the pulsing neural network, thinking. Hey, Tony, I said. Yes? You said a hacker gave people heart attacks. Well, arrhythmia, actually, but close enough for government work, Tony said. Why? Is it possible for a hacker to implant suicidal thoughts? I asked. Tony frowned at this for a minute, considering. Are we talking general feelings of depression leading to suicidal thoughts, or specific thoughts like, today I should eat a bullet? Either, I said. Both. You could probably cause depression through a neural network, yeah, Tony said. That's a matter of manipulating brain chemistry, which is something networks do already. He pointed up at his network simulator, although usually accidentally. The patch I'm doing now is designed to stop just that sort of chemistry manipulation. What about specific thoughts? Probably not, Tony said. If we're talking about thoughts that feel like they're originating from a person's own brain, generating images and noises that come from the outside is trivial. We're both doing it right now. This room is a mutually agreed upon illusion. But directly manipulating consciousness so that you make someone think they're thinking a thought you give them, and then making them act on it, is difficult. Difficult or impossible, I asked. I never say impossible, Tony said. But when I say difficult here, I mean that as far as I've heard, no one's ever done it. And I wouldn't know how to do it, even if I wanted to, which I wouldn't. Because it's unethical, I prompted. Hell yes, Tony said. And also because I know if I've figured it out, someone else has too. Because there's always someone else smarter out there who may not have ethics. And that would really mess with shit. It's hard enough to believe in free will as it is. So, I said, really difficult, but not actually impossible. Really, really, really difficult, Tony allowed. But theoretically possible because... hey, it's a quantum physics universe. Why do you ask, Chris? I sense this is not an entirely idle question. What's your work schedule look like, I asked. Tony nodded upward. It looks like my patch is doing what it's supposed to do. Once I clean it up a bit, which should take less than an hour, I'll send it off, and then I'm free. Have you ever done work for the federal government? I live in Washington, D.C., Chris, Tony said. Of course I've done work for the government. I have a vendor ID and everything. Do you have a security clearance? I've done confidential work before, yes, Tony said. Whether on the level you seem to be thinking about is something I guess we'd have to find out. I may have a job for you then, I said. Involving neural networks? Yes, I said. Hardware and software. When would you want me to start? Probably tomorrow, I said. Probably, like, 9 a.m.? Tony smiled. Well then, he said, I should probably finish up what I'm doing so I can at least attempt to get some sleep. Thanks, I said. No, Tony said. Thank you. It's not every day that a new housemate comes bearing work. That makes you officially my favorite housemate. I won't tell, I said. No, go ahead and tell, Tony said. Maybe it'll inspire a competition. That'll work out for me. I could use the work. Chapter 14. Don't tell Trin I said this to you, Captain Davidson said, pointing to the 5 Haydens he had in his holding cell. But I will be delighted if the FBI took these idiots off our hands. The 5 Haydens, or more accurately their threeps, glared at me, Van, and Davidson from the other side of the holding cell. We could tell they were glaring because their threep models came with customized heads that displayed faces and expressions. The faces these threeps carried were not their owners' actual faces, unless their owners were the spitting images of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Thomas Paine, and Alexander Hamilton. The threeps were also wearing colonial-era uniforms, which may or may not have been historically accurate. It was like an elementary school diorama of the Continental Congress come to life. The threeps were just threeps, of course. The Haydens driving them were somewhere else in the country. But when you're a Hayden and you're arrested in your threep, if you disconnect, that's considered resisting arrest and fleeing the scene. This fact was a courtesy of a young, rich Hayden who in the early years of threeps carelessly knocked down an old lady, disconnected from her threep in a panic, and then spent 3 years and a couple $100,000 of mommy's money trying to get out of what would have been a standard issue moving violation. She eventually also ended up adding perjury and bribery to her docket. She should have just done the community service. Thus, our colonials, cooling their heels and glaring through their pixels. What are you in for, George? I asked Washington. Davidson had called us in to deal with several different Haydens in his holding cells. This was the first bunch. For exercising our constitutional Second Amendment rights, Washington said. His real name was Wade Swope from Milltown, Montana. His information was popped up in my view. Here in the dictatorship of the District of Columbia, a man is apparently stripped of his right to bear arms. Van turned to Davidson. Shocked. Shocked I am to find men with guns somehow landing in jail. Yes, well, Davidson said, our founding father here is correct that he has the right to bear arms, which in this case were long rifles for each of them. The party's skipping over is where his little group of colonial fighters went into a coffee shop, private property, and started to make a scene, and when they were told to take a hike, commenced to wave their rifles around. We have it on the store video, not to mention the phone of every single person in the store. We're here to be the security detail for the march, said Thomas Jefferson, a.k.a. Gary Height of Arlington, Virginia. We're a militia consistent with the Constitution. We're here to defend our people. You might be a militia, I said, but I don't think waving your firearms around in a coffee shop accurately describes well-regulated. Who cares what you think, said Patrick Henry, a.k.a. Albert Box of Ukiah, California. You're standing with them. Those who oppress us, he pointed to me. You are a traitor and a sellout. It occurred to me that Henry/Box actually had no idea who I was, although I don't know if that would have changed his opinion any. I glanced over at Van and Davidson. Oppressing us, as in we Haydens, or oppressing you, dudes waving around firearms in a coffee shop, I asked. I want to be clear on the depth of my traitorness. You know what confuses me, Shane? Davidson said before any of them could answer. Tell me, I said. Davidson motioned at the Colonial Haydens. On one hand, these guys seem like your basic crazy conservative types with a Second Amendment